Righto, friends. This may be the final episode of the Fox Wizard podcast for season one. Things will be changing at some point soon, but I thought I've been sitting on this particular notion, trying to write of it. I feel like podcast is a good form for it. I'm going to be talking to you today, talking with you today, sharing what's on my mind today, on a topic pertaining to knowledge of curses. Now, this isn't the this isn't the most buoyant topic necessarily, but I feel it good to. There's going to be a slight expunging on my behalf to lift something that I've been carrying for some time via elucidation. So in this episode, we're going to be talking about curses themselves, the curse of knowledge, and cursed knowledge. Three distinct elements within the vague concept of knowledge of curses. If you're new, I'm Jason Fox, aka Fox Wizard. Now, Fox Wizard emerged during the pandemic times, and I've found the aspect of Fox Wizard. I've been describing this as my moonlight persona. I wish for all of us to have a moonlight persona, some sort of mythic, alternative, numinous mode that allows us to perhaps venture and explore beyond the Overton window, beyond the limitations of rationality itself, so that we might open ourselves to other ways of seeing, being, and knowing. This has been quite the journey for me, particularly as I came from quite a decade of being Dr. Jason Fox, who was, originally the science-based alternative to extroverted motivational speakers and fist-pumping rah-rah. That's at least how I positioned it when The Game Changer came out. And yet, before Dr. Jason Fox was a thing, there was a younger version of me that was quite into all of this, would wander off into the forests. I had a particularly lovely association with a hidden little swamp in near my university where I'd wander off at night time. There were long-necked tortoises there. There's long been a relationship for me and other worlds, and in recent times I've been in the underworld and surfaced from my forays in the dark forest, and so I'm feeling like a new season beckons. My work with John Anthony and Kindred Spirits has certainly helped to lift things. And at the same time, I do like to dally in the dark. So this episode shall do that. I think settle in if you're looking for top tips, quick fixes, neat hacks, easy answers, and so forth. You found the wrong podcast. But if you'd like to perambulate with me and have a wending, wandering through domains that aren't commonly discussed, you'd be welcome company. So, I am sharing this with you right now at the at the writer's shack on the property owned by my dear friends Paul Carney and Annie Lewis. They've recently purchased a property in Bruny Island, which, if you don't know, is a small island off of Tasmania, which is a kind of medium island off of Australia, which is a large island continent, one of the only, I think, island continents in the world. So it's an island off an island off an island, and I'm sitting here next to a pond that has superb blue wrens skipping along the surface. There's a slight drizzle, so I'm seeing the little ripples of the water drop upon here, and you might hear the bird songs all around. There are so many birds. I don't know the names to most of these birds. Got some frogs as well. There's a hooting owl in the distance, which is welcome company. Did an overnight camp a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. My first one in a long time, a solo overnight camp, and I had an owl keeping me company for most of the nights. So I felt good. And interestingly, I had a message from Simon van der Els, who you might remember from the A Shaman and a Wizard Walk in a Bar podcast we did a long while back, over a year ago. He too was in a similar space, although albeit he's in France, and it was lovely just comparing a little video of the scenes that we're in. I'm very grateful here that Paul and Annie have let this hermit wizard come to do a writing retreat. This is ostensibly for the book that I've been writing over the past eight years, and it does pertain to knowledge of curses, because I do feel that ever since I talked about the hermetic disposition in the last episode, it really reawakened for me a bunch of sensibilities that work for me at a subconscious level, non-conceptual knowing, a kind of resonant, attuned way of being that manifests when I'm doing my facilitation and group work, and I often feel so alive during that. And the times in betwixt, it's what I'm trying to say here is things are shifting, and this podcast is going to help. As I speak to you, there's a superb blue wren dancing on the surface of the pond, because the pond has some plant matter on the surface. Oh, so fascinating, so wonderful. So, curses. I should point out I did a fair bit of cleansing work before about to start this episode, and there shall be no curses, and I'm going to do my best to avoid curse words, such as the F word, which seems to make its way into a lot of my podcasts these days. That may still slip, but that's probably, that's milk toast compared to, you know, what people traditionally mean when we talk of curses. I should also point out, this is not my domain of magic. I call myself a wizard. There is a more accurate term, but let's not go there. This is probably a little bit more the domain of witches and other practitioners. So respectfully, I'm just going to sketch an outline. Curses are a kind of long-term binding. And to actually go about cursing something, which is not something I would recommend, that is not right relations, you'd have to have suffered incredible wrongs. And if you are going to curse something, you're binding yourself to their fate as well. I'm going to make a distinction between curses and hexes, because I think so, you know, sometimes when you're teaching things, you need to draw out, I mean, my favorite way is to draw out at least three examples so that one can avoid fixating upon the nodes and look at the relations between them, and thus, through the interrelationality, sense a better picture of what I'm talking about. I'm going to give you two in this stage. Curses are kind of a long-term binding. Hexes are a short-term. They're more immediate, they're more focused. You cast a hex, whereas with a curse, you set a curse. Curses involve a fair bit of ritual, a fair bit of sacrifice, and as I say, you bind yourself to their fate. So it's really quite dire, not recommended. A curse, you know, if we get a little bit Nordic here, we talk about wyrd, or weird, as we call it these days, weird, W-Y-R-D. I really like weird. I really, really like weird. I really like the notion of the Norns, the Fates, the three sisters that have kind of got a pattern in place. I like it because the pattern itself is not completely deterministic, and so we, as ecological expressions, born of and from and into and part of life and nature and the complex interrelations itself, you know, there are certain patterns, genetic, circumstantial, and then just in a mundane sense, the habituation that we have, these patterns, you know, we can be hijacked. We can fall into infinite scrolls. We can fall into defaults that we become blind to. And these defaults determine the pattern. And so what can start off as a groove can turn into a rut. But the thing I like about word is we can slip the pattern a little bit. We have a bit of agency in amongst this. we have a way that we can relate. There is. I'm not saying there's a lot of maneuverability. I don't believe in preordained destiny, but there's directionality. There's situationality. There's the, if you are awake, alive, and attuned, you'll have moments, your kairos moments, where you'll have the glint, you'll have a sense that you can go against yourself, or at least you can go against the automaticity, the machine mode. This is very Gurdjieffian here, where we're talking about the fourth way. And that then starts to get into territory of our daemon, of essence, of other forces that we are agents of and working on behalf of. And I'm starting to veer from what I'm talking about you with curses. Suffice to say, don't do curse work. Don't dabble in curses. So curses can only be either severed via folks who know what they're doing and can work with the binds that have been placed upon, if it's you, placed upon you, or they can be lifted once certain conditions are met. Whereas a hex is kind of like a slightly more powerful version of a cantrip. It requires active maintenance, and usually that will just trip you up or befuddle you or give you a bit of bad luck or forget something or things of that nature. Hexes are fine. Still, don't be dabbling in this stuff, I say. As I say, but with respect, this is not my magic. The reason I talk about curses, knowledge of curses, is I really want to get onto the other two things, but I do find this fascinating. And I do also like to vex, which is slightly different to hex. I probably could have added that as a trinity. Curses, hexes, and vexes. I do like to vex and befuddle folks, largely because it enlivens and awakens them. It has them lean in to a deeper kind of listening. I remember Nassim Taleb, who has of mixed, not everyone loves Nassim. I particularly very much appreciate what he's contributed to the mix. I'm not some Silicon Valley tech bro. I think that's pretty evident. A lot of such folks fetishize the writings of Nassim Taleb. But there is a deep wisdom within it. And I remember one time Nassim saying that when he's giving a presentation, he won't try to project his voice clearly. Instead, he'll speak as he normally does, and that requires people to lean in and to take more note. And this is interesting because the default we have is just to make things easy for people. Artificial intelligence is certainly accelerating this, but the result of that is people don't learn. People don't learn. We're already seeing this with regards to artificial intelligence in schools and education. Students can hack and find the shortcuts and basically sidestep the experience that they would otherwise get in the struggle of learning. And I would say that many of us are doing this. We seek out the swift, expedient, fluent, efficient, easy, cheap answers. And in the process, sidestep our own experience of the curiosity, the engagement, the questing, the struggle, the learning, the genuine learning, in exchange for, the convenience. And this kind of relates to what Zach Stein talks about with cognitive atrophy. Brilliant example he has where he's saying that, you can go to the gym and lift heavy things, and it's hard to do, and you'll struggle to do it. But in the process of doing it, you'll grow your muscles. Or you can go to the gym, and perhaps there's a contraption there that you can, an exoskeleton you can step into, and that will help you to lift heavy weights with much less effort. You can lift 10 times the amount that you would otherwise want to lift. But the thing is, if you keep using that, your actual muscles will atrophy because you've got this machine doing the heavy lifting for you. And the analogy here is this is what's happening with large language models and the way many people are approaching how they seek resolution to the questions that they have. Yeah, so hence why I do like to vex folks. I cannot help myself. I do feel that the journey is all the richer if we take the circuitous path. It's like, once I did this amazing hike to this location, and oh God, it was tough. I can't remember exactly where, but I don't remember the parable of it. Got there, and then I saw, wait a minute, what's that over there? And there's a lookout that you can drive to. And this is where you get the tourists that will come. They'll check, you know, tick the box. They've seen that particular area, take their photos, take their selfies. But have they really seen it? Do they really know it? Yes. Curses, hexes, and vexes. One last thing I'll say about curses. Kim and I, when we're walking around, there are some places that we've just picked up on over years that we're pretty sure are cursed. There are cursed properties. And by that, we've just seen businesses consistently fail in these places. Even though the location seems right, you know, I was trying to think, is it just the feng shui? Is it just the lighting? Is it just the location? What's going on here? But several businesses, different businesses, they just arrived there and just seemed doomed to fail. Doom is probably another word. Doom is even bigger than curses. I'm not gonna flirt too closely to doom. I might mention it a little bit later. It does pertain to some things, but so what would you do if you took over a cursed property? You know, if you had a sense that ill luck befells this place. I'm not sure. I really don't know. I suspect that you would want to involve some folks who have a sense of these things. I suspect that you'd want to come into right relations with whatever entities or spirits are of the place, and you'd want to do some reconciling at a level beyond simply giving it a new paint job. This is out of my domain of expertise. So let's move on to the second element of knowledge of curses. The curse of knowledge. This is a psychological bias that, you know, you could look up the Wikipedia page for this. I don't have access to the internet here, so I'm just riffing as I sit here amongst the birds. I just had a mosquito land on me. Normally that's a perilous omen, but they've been relatively friendly here, so I'm pretty happy. Although it's an interesting thing, speak of curses and such dark things. No, I'm feeling good. Okay. just a little resonant check in there. I used the word resonance there. I was looking up, I was trying to articulate one of those things. As part of the hermetic disposition, reminded me that in Dungeons and Dragons, bards, their magic rather works through resonance than wizards. This is why I say I'm not actually a wizard. A wizard will have to carry around a spell book and memorize certain incantations and somatic gestures and things of that nature. That's most people aren't really well versed in magic anyway, so wizard is a good placeholder, and I like the etymology of it, how it originates from wise man or wise person. Wizard shouldn't be gendered, but it is most of the time. That's changing, but I do like the expression of wisdom. I also like that Terry Pratchett quote I had from a while back, that the role of not doing magic was one of the chief tasks of a wizard. Not doing magic because they can't do magic, but not doing magic because they can, they choose not to. And I think there's something about the wisdom of resisting power that wizards do so well. And this is particularly expressed in Ursula Le Guin's The Wizard of Earthsea series and a lot of the disposition that she carries there. There is a somber wisdom to how we relate to power and the consequences of using power, and the sense of maintaining right relation to power. Anywho, Curse of Knowledge. Curse of Knowledge is when you know so much about a particular domain that your ability to empathize with folks who may be new to such knowledge really is really quite diminished. And this is something that teachers are able to sidestep somewhat, or at least transpose or work with. Teachers obviously have much greater knowledge than their students, but they have the patience and the ability and the empathy to meet the students where they're at, and a comfort in telling what folks call lies to children, in inverted commas. Lies to children are fictions that are necessarily stepping blocks for a student to arrive at a deeper kind of knowledge. So an example of this might be as you're teaching about physics and you're looking at the atom, and you'll draw a picture of an electron orbiting an atom. That's not necessarily how electrons work, because it gives the implication that the electron is a solid little mini sphere orbiting the proton and the neutron. And yet, to jump straight to the electron field and to quarks and to all of that stuff would be, and to get like quantum, that would be too much too soon. And so there's a kind of pacing that involves some fictions that nonetheless smuggle in some truth and serve as foundations for deeper learning and for greater accuracy. I've heard Martin Shaw describe myths as beautiful lies that harbour a deeper truth, or tell a deeper truth. I like that. Beautiful lies that tell a deeper truth. A lot of truth is carried through mythology, through folklore, through stories. A lot of timeless wisdom is carried in that way. So on the surface, it seems silly. But when you look, when you perceive, when you sense deeper, there is immense profundity that such things smuggle in. So the curse of knowledge, though, which is something that I have a bit of, you might have noticed, is where, well, here's my issue. I try to relate to everyone horizontally. I have this inner sense that we are all kindred spirits, that we are all ultimately peers, that there is no greater than or less than, not really, unless it's theatrical, unless we're doing some sort of, you know, we're all infinite players playing these finite games that allow, you know, that mean that we need to take on certain roles and adopt certain postures. But beneath it all, we're all kindred spirits. So I'm always trying to relate to folks kind of with this knowing glint, like, you know, you with me. Which means then that I forget about the fact that I've been privileged enough to do a PhD and to have had a career pathway that allows me to research fields both wide and deep. And I have an epistemological humility at times that allows me to treat knowledge without the inflated rarefication or reverence, but also to carry an assumption that, everyone knows this, right? And as a result, I consistently hear that that people are a bit befuddled. Now, as I say, I like to vex and befuddle. I like it because it enlivens us to rise to the complexity of our times. When I encounter a word that I haven't heard of before, it lights me up. I'm like, ooh, what is that? What does that mean? I'm so happy to ask what that word means if I don't understand it, or I'll just right click and look it up if I'm in front of a screen. I love this. I love language. Language. I lament. You know, I'm part of a long lineage of lamenters here, but I lament the homogenization, the simplification, the loss of the rare and archaic words that are so apt and so poetic and so exquisite, in exchange for emoticons and plain, simple language. Language that, as Ursula Le Guin writes in an essay pertaining to mother tongue and father tongue, you know, where publishers and all the forces are conspiring to have us reduce our language into something Hemingway could understand. I love that there's this exquisite burn here, because Hemingway writes so simply, but there's an implication here that there is some sophistication and nuance and subtlety that is lost in that process. No shade on Hemingway. Hemingway does wonders with simple words. It's just, you know, there is this homogenization within modernity that serves the machine, where everything colored get renders into black and white, and in that process of desaturation and pixelation, we lose a lot of the texture of life, and I miss that. And anyway, but apparently for some of my fancy words that I use, I've heard people say to me, I feel dumb. And that's like one of the swiftest arrows to my heart, is like, I would never want for someone to feel dumb. It genuinely breaks my heart. I feel like when someone shares that, I feel like, oh no, have I inadvertently been some sort of intellectual bully or something? Have I been so caught up in my own, you know, my own lust for the linguistic that I've left people behind, and worse, that I've created the conditions in which they feel dumb. Now, a lot of us have, you know, different upbringings and a different relationship to learning. I would say that the school system that many folks within my generation, as I'm an elder millennial, really didn't foster the conditions of encouragement that we are seeing many schools do a better job of today. And so many of us have traumas and deep wounds and, you know, a narrative that harbors a sense of lack or not enoughness regarding learning and academic achievement. And I really feel for that. And it's never, ever, ever my intent for folks to feel dumb. I want folks to feel delight. I want folks to feel that exquisite beckoning that curiosity brings, that the muse has when she steps into our worlds, that the sense of like, oh, there's more. What else do I not know? I feel like one of the saddest things is an absence of questions. When someone sits in the throne of all the answers that they've cobbled together, I mean, where does that lead? It feels like a finite game to me. You know, there's this, like that quote from Marshall Rosenberg, there are at least two kinds of games that we can play. The first is the game of who's right. It's a game in which everyone loses. The second is the game of making life wonderful. And that's the game that I like to play, although I will admit sometimes I do slip into the rivalrous dynamics. I'll talk about that in the next section. And sometimes I slip into my own wounded sense of who's right and so on. But I just wish for all of us to have an orientation towards curiosity and to feel safe expressing curiosity. It's never an issue to ask questions. Never. I mean, I say this, I mean, I think I wrote a post about this, about weaponized naivete. I don't like the word weaponized necessarily, but sometimes coming into a context and asking the seemingly, in inverted commas, dumb question, the question that might feel obvious, But it is also the question that is on so many people's minds that hasn't actually been asked for some time in the process of asking it. Just like the Fool in Tarot, the beginning of the Tarot journey here, the naivety, the innocence, the new beginnings, the asking of that question enables perhaps the beginning of a new cycle, enables us to revisit questions that we may have answered in a previous context a long time ago, but they're worth, you know, that they beckon a revisiting. Never a bad idea to ask a good question, a bad question, a dumb question, a question that's seemingly irrelevant. If your body is feeling moved to ask a question, do it. Oh gosh, oh, if only we could have more people asking questions. If only we could live in a world where our curiosity eclipses our conviction. Too much conviction. Too much conviction. I remember Krista Tippett, the beautiful host of On Being, podcast that I dearly, dearly love. I remember someone asking her, would you interview Sam Harris? Sam Harris has obviously got his mindfulness app and, you know, he shares his opinion about a lot of things. And Krista Tippett's response was, I probably wouldn't. He's just got too much conviction. And I mean, at least that's my memory of it. But I really liked the sense of wisdom that comes from perhaps even just sidestepping such conversations. And conversations on being a warm and intimate and vulnerable, and there's a kind of a tenderness to it. And just knowing that sacred context means that, yeah, I'd probably be hesitant to invite a high conviction person too. I've in my first podcast that I, well, not really my first, probably my second one, that I ended up haphazardly deleting, I had interviewed a few thought leaders, and there were just a couple of occasions where I was met with high conviction. And this is a thing in the Thought Leaders Business School, which I used to be a mentor of. I have deep respect for the curriculum of Thought Leaders Business School and for Matt Church, who founded it. But one of the things, though, is for thought leaders to have high conviction. Got to have conviction. And this is a very father tongue thing. It works within capitalism, when everyone is feeling a sense of uncertainty and doubt, people tend to look for the confident, charismatic, fluent, high conviction leaders that seem to have no doubt. For me, high conviction signals perhaps a lack of intelligence. This sounds so judgy, but I'm trying to do an inversion here. It's the one that's not sure. The one that has doubt, the one that's confused, the one that is expressing, I don't know what's going on to me. That is the one with the, I guess, greater intelligence, wisdom, perspicacity. Perspicacity is a word I love to write. Perspicacity, a keen, shrewd, and ready insight into things. Oh, they're the ones. So, yeah, let your curiosity eclipse your conviction, I say. Allow me to paraphrase from memory and to potentially butcher a poem from Wendell Berry. I read an article recently saying, like, this is one of the downsides of reading Wendell Berry, is when you start to get into Wendell Berry's poetry, you'll start listening to land, you'll start having to reconcile with the cognitive dissonance of all the harm and damage that we've done. You'll start to be attuned, you'll start to, I guess, feel into the livingness, the aliveness, and what we're doing, and that's going to shape and change you. Anywho, I've said this before many times. It seems apt right now as we wrap up the curse of knowledge. It could be that when we no longer know which way to go, that we've begun our real journey. And when we no longer know what to do, we have arrived at our real work. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. That's Our Real Work by Wendell Berry. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. That's. That's why I love bafflement. This is why Nassim Taleb says difficulty awakens the genius. And we live in a world that is making things so easy, so smooth, so convenient. You know, even video games, you look at video games. Back in my day, you would struggle. There was no such thing as saving. You really had to be alive and attuned. You couldn't have anyone walk in front of you whilst you're playing a game. If you were stuck, you needed to talk to friends during school. You needed to go to the news agency and maybe see if there's a magazine that has written about it. Find some tips in the magazine. There used to be phone lines where you could literally call someone and speak to a person, and they would give you some advice about how to tackle the games. but nowadays, if you're stuck, you can just watch a YouTube video instantaneously and find out what to do. All the secrets are revealed anyway on the internet, and the games themselves, particularly the large publishers, are so paranoid that you won't know what to do that they're usually signaling and leading like a very obvious trail as to what to do next. And in fact, the word quest has suffered from semantic capture. To quest is to, let me give you the technical version, then I'm going to give you the mythopoetic version, then I'm going to give you the conventional version. The technical version, the one that I use in How to Lead a Quest, my best-selling book that came out 10 years ago, to quest is to search for viable alternative options to the default ways of doing things. Our defaults are the options we choose automatically in the absence of viable alternatives. So therefore, the only way we can venture beyond the default is to find alternative options to the default and then to see whether they're viable. The questing is in the seeking of viable alternative options to the default ways of doing things. To quest means we have an open mind. Every question literally begins with a quest. We have an orientation and a disposition that is aware, alive, awake, attuned. We are paying attention to the penumbra, to weak signals. We are operating in complex and emergent domains, so we synthesize weak signals, we do light experiments, we test, we accrue knowledge, and then at some point we have a sense of a viable alternative option, and should the right conditions manifest, we can enact that option, and that will lead ultimately to a more meaningful kind of progress. Meaningful progress is that which brings us closer to future relevance. Future relevance means that whatever it is we're doing, we have congruence and coherence to the context. Whatever we're doing makes sense given the context that we're in. And the opposite of meaningful progress is the delusion of progress. The delusion of progress is where default thinking gets in the way of meaningful progress. Our defaults are the options we choose automatically in the absence of viable alternatives, and they often are safe, familiar, predictable, convenient, and easy to measure. They have precedence. And this is the world that we are locked in. We are locked into defaults. It's been a very long time since we've seen anything original emerge from Hollywood. You've got the same things. The money and power has us locked into this homogenizing default, and we are circling around and around in this as we're experiencing further extraction. The default condition is what we must escape, and to do that, we need to quest. And if I switch mythopoetically, to quest is to engage in what may be a perilous journey. And the perilous journey is led by a question. It's not led by an outcome, not necessarily. There might be the Grail Quest, but no one knows where it is. You know, you don't have a destination. You don't have a specific place to go. You're led by your muse, your daemon, an inner restlessness. You are guided by inklings, hunches, and intuitive reckonings. Your pathway is non-linear. It's fraught with peril. It may loop. It may spiral. It may take you to places you don't want to go. And part of the quest often involves a journey to the underworld, a descent to the underworld. It often involves hardship and loss, grief and sorrow. it involves a tempering, a kind of a journey in which you will ultimately come back changed. And yet the word quest, Joseph Campbell has popularized the hero's journey as the monomyth. Many mythologists take issue with this. And of course, there are plenty more plenty more structures for stories, particularly throughout history. Ursula Le Guin knows this. Miyazaki knows all the Studio Ghibli films that Miyazaki knows this. And yet we seem to have this fetishization and this, we are enamored by the boy myth, the boy with sword, the orphan boy with sword that goes and conquers dragons and demons and gets the treasure and comes back changed. And this, ultimately, the semantic capture of the word quest is, you'll see it now in role-playing games, where a quest is almost like a fetch task. You're given a clear objective of what to do. You're given the milestones of what you need to go do it. There's a map where you, within exactly where you need to go, and a sequence of tasks and how you get there. Add in gamification, if we want to add a little bit of a late stage capitalist twist to it, you're going to have incentives and rewards, badges, points, ways that you can measure yourself against your progress towards this quest. And alas, this is how people relate to quest. I experienced this with How to Lead a Quest. I think that people see questing as a kind of aesthetic to goal setting. And they're often baffled and vexed by the approach that I take. But if it's meaningful progress you seek, then yeah, let's quest. Let's quest properly. If it's simply the attainment of a preordained outcome, then where's the aliveness in that? Where's the curiosity in that? You're simply fetching an answer that you already know. Why ask the question if you already know the answer? Oh, in a world of easy answers, better questions are the new scarcity. I read that as an article. Anyway, that's Curse of Knowledge for you. Now, let's talk about cursed knowledge. Now, I thought this little story that I have the whiff of came from my friend Vaz Clementine. Vaz has been running over a year of story medicine nights in Kangaroo Valley. I think it's Kangaroo Valley, out near Warrandyte. Beautiful sessions. Kim and I would drive to about 40-minute drive for us. And just a lovely gathering of warm-hearted, bright-minded folk sitting together in this space and hearing stories. Vaz has trained with Martin Shaw. He has beautiful sensibilities of a bard, the appropriate reverence for story and the animacy of stories themselves, their shape-shifting, mercurial nature. And I just love it because after the story medicine, we sit by the fire. That's actually something I've enjoyed here with PK Paul on his property. It was quite cold here when I first got here, and we had a beautiful whiskey by the fire. John Anthony got me this advent calendar of 25 whiskeys on the way to Christmas. And I haven't been able to drink a whiskey a day, but I did save a few, and it was a delight to share with them and with PK and take some notes. And the Kindred Spirits has been great. And just hanging with Kindred Spirits. I had a lovely dinner with my friend Michael Dixon and Mikey Ellis and a bunch of folks. And it's just like, far out. This is what we need to. And this is my hope for 2026, is that we're all going to shift to favoring that more. I think we're all going to realize that so many of us are addicted to our screens. And as parents, it's sending a really bad signal to the kids. And I saw one person make this lovely prediction that unfollowing and blocking influences may become a thing, that folks are going to start to wrest back control from the algorithms. There's a newsletter out by Manu Moriel called De-Algorithmed, or de-algorithm, a process of disentangling oneself from algorithmic feeds. I know many of my friends have quit Spotify, switched to services that value the artists more. At the same time, I do like a bit of an algorithm sometimes. I left Spotify a long while ago, but discovery hasn't been quite as good, but it's forcing me into the friction of opening me up to other senses. And so when we went out to see this live performance the other night, I was exposed to live music that I wouldn't have popped up in my feed. In fact, you know what? It's so much better because Spotify was trained upon my dark chapter time, so it would keep on feeding me this kind of ambient, drone, dark, minimalist, textured, doom-laden music. You know, think of deep, rasping, droning cello or a kind of, you know, the sound of a saxophone played really low, just droning on. Yeah, so no matter what I tried to do, either Spotify would give me the paid, you know, stuff that they sneak in or just heaps of that. So it's a good thing. yes, cursed knowledge. So I don't know who this story came from. I thought it came from Baz. But it's this parable, it's this religious parable. I didn't grow up with a religion, so I'm only recent to the deeper wisdoms and the poetics of it. James Cass has helped awaken me to this, as well as some friends. To quote Nassim Taleb again, I seem to quote him a bit today, these days. I remember him saying something like, the problem with atheists and fundamentalists is they both take religion too literally. And I really like that. And I think it also speaks to the hyper-rational frame that modernity encourages that allows for the law of the excluded middle, where nothing can be both things. It's either this or that. But with poetry, with myth, you entertain the both and. To be more specific, the both and either or and neither nor nature of it all. both and either or and neither nor of it all. Yeah, that's the way. You've got to dance amongst it. Rationality itself is great. I'd much prefer someone who is rational than irrational or anti-rational. Let's be clear that I would much rather someone be rational than anti-rational or irrational. But my hope for someone who has the foundations of rationality is that we can start to explore the pararational, the meta-rational, and the transrational. Rationality itself is fantastic, but it is limited. There are some things that rationality alone will not allow us to see or perceive, and thus we need to, you know, slip the cage a little bit without losing the tether. I think some mystics, of which I am not one, but I think some mystics are able to lose the tether for long enough and then return with profundity. Perhaps profundity that is ineffable, so it doesn't translate into language, which again reminds me of my I really love this definition of intuition, non-conceptual knowing. Like, there is a knowingness with intuition, like, you know, and then people will ask you, how did you know? And you'll be forced to do some sort of post hoc rationalization in which you conceptualize or at least attempt to conceptualize what is a non-conceptual knowing, a deep attunement to pattern, which is another thing of just knowing that the body has its own set of intelligences. And, oh gosh, so many years of me not listening to body, so caught up in my head. So let me just quote another favorite thing from this year that I got. I've been passively smoking Kim's gestalt therapist training. Lose your mind and come to your senses. Lose your mind and come to your senses. I quite like that. And there's this another one that complements it nicely. Heart-led thinking, full body sensing. And I like this perhaps even more because it's still, you know, we still want to be thinking, but it's heart-led thinking. And then it's also full body sensing, of which the head is part of this. And this perhaps skirts into territory of Ian McGilchrist's The Master and His Emissary, which really advances the concept beyond the whole left brain, right brain dichotomy. And pedestals are right. Sorry, I just said it went beyond that, but we've lived in this period of modernity that has pedestaled logic and reasoning and rationality and cold calculation above and beyond all the other ways of knowing. And it's nice to see some attempt to restore. Whew, I'm avoiding this topic, you see. This, oh gosh, so let me tell you the story then. The story that I thought Vaz Clementine shared me. Apparently there was this priest who came across someone. This is why I'm not yet a full bard. I don't know what to call myself, a thaumaturge. I don't know, but anyway, this person was completely innocent, had grown up with no knowledge of sin, and the priest explained, you know, you can't do that because that is sinful. And the person was like, what is sin? And blah, 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 and was eventually educated on what is sin. And then this person asked the priest, can someone who has no knowledge of sin, sin? Like, if you don't have any knowledge of sin, is it possible for you to sin? And the priest was like, No, you'd be free of sin without knowledge of sin. And the person's like, so why the fuck did you tell me? Why did you tell me this? And the priest was saying something like, yeah, well, once you have knowledge of stuff, you kind of behooved to tell people. Oh, dear. And this is my segue to cursed knowledge. Knowledge of the metacrisis is cursed knowledge. It is cursed knowledge. It's something that has been with me quite heavily for some time. The Hermetic Disposition stuff has helped me to slip that a little bit. The Josh Schreier episode on the Emerald on burdens helped me to see it a little bit. And there's been maybe it's an astrological thing, a turning of the seasons or the cycles or something, but after many years wandering in the dark forest, having knowledge of the metacrisis, I've been trying to share this knowledge with folks, but it's cursed knowledge. It's not the kindest thing to do. It feels like it's important, but it's not the kindest thing to do. So I will describe the knowledge of the metacrisis as an insight cascade. I think many of us are very good at having cognitive defenses to protect ourselves from insight cascades. An insight cascade is where you realize one thing, and that insight, you're like, hang on, but what about blah? And then knowledge of that then is like, oh shit, well, what about blah? And you have this cascade, this insight cascade. Much like when you're seeing a sand pyramid and you're putting extra grains of sand on, and you just don't know which grain of sand is going to create the cascade that is effectively ontologically destabilizing. So, you know, one of the things is if you start to genuinely explore what money is, it could be a pathway to the insight cascade. I was very good at resisting this for some time. My training is in living systems. So I studied in the School of Environmental Sciences, looking across multiple sciences, atmospheric, soil science, ecological sciences, population, communicable diseases, all of these different things, all of these interconnected, transdisciplinary, boundary-crossing, complex, open context, nebulous yet patterned concepts. So, you know, I was learning them. This is also part of adult development. You learn, you categorize, you box things, and so on. But eventually, for some of us, the categorizations, the boxes, the ontology, the ground in which the rational structure and order of which we make sense of things, that ground softens, and then we get to a point where we realize it was never solid ground in the first place. And as I mentioned in the last episode, Robert Keegan and later David Chapman, who I really love and admire, have come to kind of call this as the nihilistic gap. You have this period where it's like, well, it's all subjective, it's all kind of, and it's a lot of postmodernists, or postmodernism itself encourages this, and you get this kind of faux, lightweight nihilism that pervades many university campuses these days. It's this... the birds are beautiful here. It's not true. You then potentially arrive at a place of meta-rationality, which relates also to meta-systemic, but it's different. Meta-rationality recognizes the pattern amidst the nebulosity and is able to be comfortable with fuzziness and a both-and-ness, a both-both-and and either-or and neither-nor-ness of it all. True enough is good enough. There's no searching for absolutes. There's a comfort with the fact that everything is asymptotic. There's no kind of arriving. In some senses, this is the horizontal disposition that James Cass writes of. And thus, this is the infinite nature rather than the finite nature of clear boundaries and clear domains and this and that and lines between this and that and boundaries and so forth. And it's nice to get to this. But part of the meta-crisis also opens you up to the fabric of hurt and bliss that Hansi Freinach introduced me to. It has you see that... I probably should define metacrisis. This is the curse knowledge. Metacrisis is an awareness of the underlying generator functions that give rise to our polycrisis. The polycrisis is the interconnected nature of crises. So it's not simply the climate crisis in which we're experiencing exponential global heating, which is then causing, you know, its own cascade of catastrophes, including what may be the sixth mass extinction, the Holocene. It also leads to the food insecurity. It leads to immigration issues. It leads to then increased geopolitical tensions as resources diminish. If we also then couple that with the way that money works, how money is a symbolic abstraction that represents a meta optionality token that allows you to have a claim on energy across, you know, that's omni across all domains, and that money itself relies on extraction, abstraction, and accumulation, and that if you accumulate more money, you can then use that money to accumulate more money, and so power laws come into effect, and if you have money, you can then influence the way that actual laws come into effect. So those with money get more money, those with power get more power. This creates incredible imbalances, which wealth inequality leads to increased social unrest. And when you get increased social unrest and people are struggling to survive and make ends meet, it's natural that they'll be forced to turn to things that people would consider to be criminal. And so then, because crime increases, because people want to feed their families, policing then increases because people don't understand the hermetic disposition, and so particularly the principle of polarity And so to combat the rise of crime, there's an equal and opposite rise in police. And this just perpetuates the same paradigm. And so you end up with a descent into what seems to be a kind of fascism, or more accurately, a kind of corporatism, in which everything is ruled by the crude metric of money, of dollars, except that metric itself does not factor in the externalities, the exponential harm that is caused when we eradicate species and destroy environments and genocide peoples and all of that. So, and then what happens because of that is you've got the market that's guiding all of this. The market is effectively what Nate Higgins would call a super organism. It's blind to its impacts, and it's on a self-terminating path. We are part of and complicit in a cancerous ideology that's literally consuming the very substrate that life depends upon. And this is the condition that we live within. And so the meta-crisis looks at the underlying generator functions of that, which largely boils down to the rivalrous dynamics that create multipolar traps. Multipolar traps are situations where if we all coordinate, everything would be fine. But as soon as one person defects, everyone defects. This is partly the prisoner's dilemma, but amplified. And so we have this race to the bottom. If we had no nuclear weapons, that would be great. If we had one person that had nuclear weapons, okay, I guess. If we have two, well, shit. If we have three, it was like, well, people are saying, oh, we need more nuclear weapons because, you know, we need to protect ourselves. But in doing so, you increase the likelihood of nuclear war. Same thing with guns. If you have no guns, I mean, one of the good things that if you do have power is you can bind the outcomes. So Australia, thank goodness, has very tough gun laws. Not that it's helped with recent events. And I've learnt the hard way that another kind of cursed knowledge is knowledge of great harms that are happening. Much better to live in a society with no guns, because then the alternative is you have the what we see with our with the folks in the United States of America, for example, of where everyone needs to feel like they have a gun in order to feel safe. But in the process of doing that, you're increasing the likelihood of dying in a gun attack. Same with resource acquisition, same with all the things, these rivalrous dynamics that birth these multipolar traps that favor, that give rise to power laws that then amplify this excess. It's beyond any attempt to solve things. And if I read an article a little while ago, which is just echoing a statement that Dave Snowden, the complexity grandfather, I don't know what to call him, but definitely one of the wisest people when it comes to complexity. He's saying that, you know, you can't bring solutions to complex contexts. Even Nora Bateson in another wonderful thing saying you can't solve a complex challenge by just swapping out the parts. This stuff that what we are contending with is paradigmatic. The closest I have as a response is there is a shift in consciousness. There is a shift which I would perhaps call this the shift to the infinite play, where you're no longer playing to win, because to do so creates losers, and you end up fueling that very same fundamental dynamic that perpetuates the meta-crisis. Finite players play to win, infinite players play to continue the play. And so part of that means also not losing, and also not trying to win. There is this subversive, almost sacred ambivalence to power games. J.R. Tolkien wrote about this with Tom Bombadil. Tom Bombadil was one of the most powerful characters in The Lord of the Rings. The Hobbits met Tom Bombadil early on in the story when they were getting lured by Old Man Willow in the dark forest there. But Tom Bombadil knew the song of things, and partly why the ring had no effect on him, the one ring the One Ring that people have made the analogy that smartphones, social media is very much like the One Ring. It's designed to allure and entrap us. Had no effect on Tom Abdul because he has no desire for power. And it's ultimately a shift in consciousness. The reason the metacrisis stuff is cursed knowledge is it creates cognitive dissonance in folks, and people's cognitive defenses kick in. And what I've noticed is, you know, it's a great way to lose friends and work. I am at my strongest when I am working with kindred spirits and smuggling sensibilities into the heart of Enterprise Land. But flagging metacrisis stuff just creates this cognitive dissonance. People don't want to really hear about it or talk about it. Just like complicity with genocide, or just like complicity with ecocide. These topics are too heavy, too rough, too they're too big of a burden for folks to hear. And so also when I look at, you know, the heroes as a young person studying living systems, ecology, eco-philosophy, environmental sciences, I'd look up to Joanna Macy, to David Suzuki, to, you know, folks who are weathered veterans in the environmental movement. And as I said in the last episode, you know, as I was learning, there was this time where we thought it was still possible. You know, all we needed to do was show people the science, show people the evidence. We've eventually rallied with the hole in the ozone layer. And of course, industry does their thing where they'll deny it, they'll deny, keep selling the CFC refrigerators and cooling systems. But whilst they're denying, they're doing the research to kind of find an alternative way. And as soon as that becomes economically viable, there is a shift, and then they go that way, and the things are solved. And we thought, oh, well, we just let people know about what we called back then global warming, a pretty benign term. Better to say global heating now. Even then, I don't know. Climate catastrophe, I don't know what to call it. But we just thought, you know, just surely we just assemble the facts and we build mounting evidence. But because we come back to money here, we come back to ultimately Moloch, the god of coordination failure, child sacrifice and perverse incentives. At the heart of all this coordination failure, because Moloch, and with the Lieutenant Mammon being the entity of greed, this is why we can't have nice things. But talking about it creates cognitive dissonance. And then if you look at Joanna Macy, a beautiful podcast she did soon before she passed away, with Jessica, I forget her name, We Are the Great Return, We Are the Great Turning. You know, Joanna Macy is, you know, with that Buddhist sensibility, just saying, yeah, well, it's too late. It's too late. David Suzuki recently came out, it's too late. Most of the senior folks that have been in this space for long, it's like, it's literally too late to avert most of the catastrophes. And this is cursed knowledge. This is cursed knowledge. Even as you hear this, even as I say this, there's something heavy. And this is where to slip the curse, there is a sacred ambivalence, a sacred... there's always the trickster's glint. There's always this sense that perhaps the times need to get to this point so that we can have our quickening, our collective quickening. And by quickening, I mean the realization of dormant or latent potential. This is potentially the promise of where we are at. And so there is this hope beyond hope, as Bayo Akamalafe talks about, this thing that we can only look away at. You can't look at directly. As soon as you look at any hope directly, it kind of withers or is revealed to be false. But there is this hope beyond hope that we can look away at, this sense that short-term, things are fucked. But mid to long-term, who knows? Who knows? And if we are aware that in these times... And I'm going to quote from Alexander Love here, from a recent podcast he had with in conversation on the integral stage with Lehman Pascal. where you talk about the season that we're in. And when you're in autumn, there's often a lot of fruits, these plump fruits. But autumn is also a time of rot and decay, of decomposition. But these fruits, they carry the seeds. And the work that we're doing now may carry the seeds that may germinate into something for the future. And so I've made a point of trying to convince people about the metacrisis, to try to talk of it, to raise people's attention about it. I created with Paul Carney, whose place I'm staying at right now, we created the Rekindling a few years ago, post-doom sensibilities for the collapse aware. And this word doom, it's so heavy, it's so big, but I come back to the word, W-R-Y-D. I think that has an etymological root to Urd, who is one of the three fates. I can't remember if she's the young one or the older one. I think she's the young one who kind of sets the path. But yeah, this doom, this sense of doom. I mean, the trajectory is terminal. Oh my gosh. I think that I just heard a swift parrot. There are some swift parrots here. Swift parrots. Swift parrots are endlings. And an endling is a species that just does not have enough population left to sustain itself. So the swift parrot is a critically endangered parrot. And I think it is, it's an endling. So it's very special and sweet and somber and sad to hear the sound of a swift parrot. Such is our times. So this is the cursed knowledge. Oh, great. But yeah, this is what I've been carrying for so long, this knowledge, this deep knowing of where we're at. And I've tried, like the priest in the story I mangled, tried to be telling folks about this. No one really appreciates hearing about this. Having the Insight Cast Guide also puts people in a dark chapter in which you do descend to the underworld. I think this is a necessary and vital and a very important maturation process that helps adolescents transition to become true adults. But no one appreciates it. Just like, if you know that the development of cognitive complexity is a function of entropy and support. You want children to be exposed to new learning experiences and then to have the support to integrate those learning experiences, but it doesn't mean you want your children to experience chaos, even though it possibly in the mid to long term would be good for them. It's similarly, telling people about the metacrisis, it's not a strategy to win friends and work. And it's also this place that I've arrived at, as I say, again, unlocked a little bit by Josh Shire's episode on burdens and the emerald, unlocked also by my return to the hermetic disposition, which is something that I intuitively channel in all the work that I do. And it's, for a long time, I've revered the role that Trickster plays, the role that Fox plays as a creature of both forest and field, oscillating betwixt, living in the liminal, being a messenger between worlds, being wily enough to evade capture. There's always this glint. There's always the trickster's glint that finds the third or the fourth, the hidden path through it all. So even though I talk of the doom, I'm aware of the weird. The weird being that, hey, we still have little glimmers and hints of agency in amidst this. We could potentially course correct, but this is so much bigger than all of us, and perhaps the thing to do is to return our focus to our locus, to be embodied and present and attuned, to listen, to love, and to lean into that which is closer to the adjacent possible. The adjacent possible is a term within complexity that has us less fixated upon the big meta theories. And now, here's where I'm at. I'm so tired of metacrisis, honestly. I do not need to hear yet another intelligent and exquisite articulation of just how doomed we are. But But there are the birds here, so beautiful. There is a way to embody, and it's a disposition. It's a different way of relating, but there's a way to slip this knot. There's a kink, perhaps, in the thread that the three fates are weaving. And hey, it might take more than our lifetimes to resolve. I do feel... I was listening to Jasmine Sun, who's this incredible writer on Substack. She's young, she's right in Silicon Valley, she's giving good, apt, witty, cultural commentary on AI and all these other things. And I remember listening to an episode, she was chatting with Celine Yuen, and they were talking about how older folks will often say how fucked everything is, how terrible it is, look at what AI is doing, and, you know, and they were saying that, yeah, but this is kind of our life. We didn't grow up in your world pre-internet. This is all we've ever known. And it made me realize that, yeah, part of this thing about cursed knowledge is, and we go back to what teachers are so good at with the curse of knowledge, the curse of knowledge of knowing you have cursed knowledge. Part of that, there is a responsibility for us to look after young folk. And that means we do need to have them have a healthy kind of hope. And at the same time, as adults, it behooves us to actually wake up and to maybe let go of the fantasies that we've been holding. That, you know, the whole, it's okay, bro, let's we're just going to build a whole bunch of new fossil fuel things to fuel AI, bro. It's all good, bro. You know, the future is going to be great. We're going to colonize Mars. We're going to give birth to the machine. It's okay, bro. Just, you know, if we leave that, if we can actually just admit, you know what? We have a responsibility here to future generations, and it behooves us to pay attention to what we are actually doing here. I don't know how many adults can actually... I mean, I'm using Bill Plotkin's terminology here of adults. So let me just rephrase to a more colloquial sense. I don't know how many adults, as in people who are my age and so on, I don't know how many adults can see beyond the kind of the hoodwink, the spell that we are under, the spell of metrics, the spell of power that has us obsess about things that will increase the numeric value of our bank accounts. If we could see beyond that, if we could open our eye of value, as David J. Temple writes of in Cosmoerotic Humanism, if we can recognize and see and train the eye of value to know what really matters, then we might be able to attune and live into the poem we were born to be. So let me leave, I'm going to wrap this up now. Let me share a quote from Léman Pascal as he spoke with Alexander Love about the post-tragic disposition. The post-tragic disposition, which is more than just a conceptual frame, but there's this a space of embodying an ability to be happy and sad, both at the same time, and a place to arrive at where you've experienced the texture of tragedy, of loss, of a deep knowing of where we're at, and yet can also still realize and remember and participate in the fact that there is still immense joy and love and meaningness and mattering and exquisite delight within this life that we have. This is from Léman Pascal. He was talking about folks that are a little bit younger than him that are all worked up about the meta crisis. He just wants to say to them, look, we're all going to die. This project is going to fail. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. And so, as the final episode of this season of the Fox Wizard podcast, next season I shall return, perhaps, you know, a little less heavy. Perhaps being a little bit more coy with this cursed knowledge that I have, in amongst other things. perhaps a little bit more attuned to the curse of knowledge, and perhaps a little bit more orientated to blessings and boons and cantrips and the everyday hermetic disposition and fox-like canny that we can bring to things. I just want to say, we're all going to die. I did a wonderful podcast episode. I was invited onto a wonderful podcast for an episode as part of A Language of Suffering with my friends Kelly and Matthew. And Kelly Butler has this wonderful expression. She's a death doula. She works very closely with hospicing and palliative care. The thing is, this condition that we have called life is terminal. All of us are going to die. Even if you're some billionaire that's investing in all sorts of life extension and you're fantasizing about, you know, living forever and immortality, which to me is a kind of spiritual stuntedness. But even if that, we are all going to die. Life is terminal. The question is, how do we get there? How do we want to live is the question. This project is going to fail. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. I love that. And so, to recall the words of someone who did the Ritual of Becoming, which you can find out at cleverness.com/word, which I'm actively reworking at the moment, particularly with a bias towards word with a Y. To quote someone who did the Ritual of Becoming, and she shared one of her three principles with me for the word for her year, romantic. And I only know this because she saw me on a tram in Melbourne and came up to me and said hello and told me about the program. If you're listening to this, please send me an email. I want to know your name so I can quote you for the following beautiful, beautiful poetic expression. One of her principles for her word for the year is a tenderness despite. A tenderness despite. And I love this expression so much, and that is what I wish for us. That even if you too now harbour cursed knowledge, and I'm sorry about that, it's just what you got to do. Hopefully all of us can move through life with a curiosity that eclipses our conviction and a tenderness despite all the seeming evil and hurt in this world, a tenderness despite the fact that there is immense unfairness and that good deeds often go unrewarded. A tenderness despite knowing that we are part of a long lineage, and this story of the garden and the machine has been tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of years in the making. A tenderness despite hearing the beauty of the swift parrot and knowing that many such species are coming to their end. It's a bit of a somber note to end up the podcast, but I am genuinely sorry about this. This is part of the burden of cursed knowledge, is that it wants to be shared. It wants to be shared. And I'm not sure what conditions need to be met in order to lift this curse. I don't know that we can sever this curse because we think we're entangled. It's part of the human condition. But I feel a little lighter for sharing it. And this comes back again to Josh Fry's comment within the Emerald podcast on burdens, that there is something to be said about not having to shoulder all of these burdens alone. And that one of the symptoms of this late-stage capitalist modernity, this post-modernity, is this sense of the individual and how wellness is all our individual responsibilities and it's all brought down to us individually. And perhaps we can just do a little bit more to look after each other. And so this episode comes to a wrap. It's close approaching the summer solstice here. summer solstice, all solstices. As I say, any day of the week could be a sacred day, but there are some that have a little bit more mythic potential. Solstices being one of them, astrological potential, solstices, birthdays, equinoxes, whatever it is. I just hope that at some stage there may be some tending to closure, some tending to some sacred endings for you, a gentle letting go of or putting down of or release of some things that have been part of your story for some time, but may have arrived at that point in which you can let them go. I wish for you some solace and some solitude, potentially. Summer solstice is much more social and festive than the winter solstice, and 'tis the season to be jolly, apparently. But I wish for you just at least a little moment to yourself, for yourself, with yourself, to tend to these endings. And then to not rush into the new beginnings, to not rush to new projects, to not rush to new responsibilities and new things, but just to allow for as long as you can, well, not as long as you can, for as long as feels right, the fertile void, the latent potentiality, the opportunity for things to emerge amidst the space that you create, and just to see where that leads. Thank you as ever for listening to me and for the encouragement you've offered along the way. I don't like to ever really ask favors. I feel like I ask a lot of folks who listen to this. One thing that would be absolutely marvelous. Actually, I'll list three things if you're feeling generous. The first is, if you're not subscribed to the newsletter, I write a newsletter. Foxwizard.com is where you can sign up. I am trying to be a little less on social media and a little bit more attentive to the newsletter. I'm going to be doing a few courses next year and conspiring ways for us to hang together both in real life, in retreat form for folks who can make it somewhere in Australia, and also online as well through some shared spaces. It's work that I used to do, and I really love such contexts. So foxwizard.com is where you can subscribe to the newsletter. The second thing is, if you feel like leaving a nice positive review for the podcast, that would be really helpful. I used to have a bunch of reviews for my old podcast, but then I kind of, as part of my descent into the underworld, I kind of immolated a lot of my past work, including that podcast. And if you've been listening for some time, 5-star review and just some nice words, if that feels true to you, it's just lovely. It helps people find the podcast. And it's deeply appreciated and very encouraging for me. And finally, the third thing. I did that thing where I just said three things. I could only think of two. Oh, the third thing is, it's the same wishes as before. I just wish for you a tenderness despite. There's a lot of heaviness in the world at the moment. There is a lot of hurt and anger and suffering, and this can be ongoingly perpetuated. My wish for you, for all of us, is that we can remember we're all infinite players here. We can play to continue the play, and in so doing, perhaps co-create a world more curious and kind. Thank you once again, friends.